welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. From the book New Dimensions 4, edited by Robert Silverberg, this Mind Web story is called The Bible After Apocalypse, written by Lawrence Jennifer. He, what was his name, Tom or Jenny, Lenny, Chen, Arthur, Dan or Bear, and a great many times one seems to be known as Juan to Make Ready, but nobody had ever called him by his real name before. He, Dismas, was not yet heavy enough with the media to chat in the staring red eyes of bloody cameras always making their own sound. He was only using some words in common with a few friends when a part of New Jersey and a suburb of Cleveland and a small town in the state of Washington became three columns of smoke. And all of the radios and suddenly pictureless television sets in the country began to talk in the voices of the people from the Crab Nebula, using slightly stilted and unreal English while the ships landed. No matter if a radio had been shut off, no matter the station it had meant to receive, the new people had methods of their own, and all other broadcasting was blanked out. The ships looked much more like ridged potato chips than like saucers of any design. Of course, this happened all over our planet at the same time, and in 80 different languages or more, but Dismas was in New York of the United States. What he had just said was that he tried to live every minute of every day as it came to him, as a whole minute or a whole day without regarding what had happened and what he had done in the past, or what might happen and what he might do in the future. He was not on a trip at that time, but it is possible that one or more of his friends was seeing visions or hearing sounds, smelling, tasting, touching things unshared by any of the others. Mind-expanding drugs lead to a lack of discipline. Dismas and all other human beings who were down and within hearing range of a radio or a television set or an electric hair dryer, which in several cases was easily manipulated by the Crab Nebula techniques, halted every bodily function except the automatic processes and listened to the alien broadcast. Human beings out of range and human beings on trips learned of it later in various ways. He, covered by chance in jeans and leather slippers and an open leather jacket with a white fur lining and a Navajo hairband, heard the voices say that the planet was to be run for the benefit of the people of the Crab Nebula from that time on, possibly as a vacation resort. And that human beings, although 75 in every 100 would be killed, were to continue as usual, perhaps more peacefully, and always under the direction of one or more of the new people who would live in their communal non-mating shells in groups of from 5 to 8 in locations that would be convenient for the human beings so to be directed. He heard that resistance was useless and that if he survived the initial period, necessary if one were to develop a less crowded planet with a slightly changed carbon dioxide, oxygen, nitrogen, neon balance, he would be treated very well, and in all probability, have his lifespan and his life enhanced by techniques which would be made available to him. The radio, which had not been on, called him Dismas. It called all of the others by their true names at the same time, as did all radios, television sets, and hair dryers throughout the world. A highly unusual technical feat, and one which helped to convince human beings everywhere, as did the destruction of comparatively thin-settled living locations here and there over the planet, that the people of the Crab Nebula meant what they said, and were really capable of meaning it. When human beings began to see them, and more speech and time became available, these people became known to most remaining Americans as crabs, but more often as Tone Emp. This being as close as human throats could approach to the pronunciation of the true name of the race. Human beings continued to be called human beings of all types. There were many different types of Tone Emp, and there were many different types of human beings, too. He, Dismas, left his friends and came out alone into the street. He did not think that the voices had been real. Very few human beings did at that time. But when he hit the street and saw all the other human beings there, he began to be confused and afraid. All of the others seemed to be very confused too, and most showed their fear, and before very many minutes had passed, Dismas knew that the others had also heard the voices of the Tone Imp, and that each of the human beings had been addressed by his true name. No human being then knew how the Tone Imp had constructed their broadcaster so that it could single out individuals, even when several were in the same room. Nor did they know that the Tone Imp had discovered the existence of an identity node within the brain tissue of every human being, and were capable of detecting and interpreting node radiation in order to know all of the true names. Animals as small as ants have this node, and can interpret other nodes right on this planet. And the node is common to several other planets where it functions in a wide variety of ways. As he watched and spoke with the other human beings in the streets, Dismas began to believe that an alien people had truly come to his planet and could destroy him and anyone else they nominated. Some of the human beings he talked with were consumed by fright and were attempting to ready themselves for a war with the aliens. Others, already prepared for war, seemed to have their fright under control and were bravely determining to eliminate as many of the alien people as possible. Some few thought that human beings could even win such a war, either through their great numerical superiority or by virtue of being human in the first place. And many others had freaked out entirely and were screaming or sitting stone silent or crying as they walked up and down in the street, or acting out their insanities in other ways, all disturbing both to themselves and to everyone else. Dismas came to the intersection of his street with a wide avenue. He turned onto the avenue and began to walk uptown. Because the avenue was wider than his street, the frenzies of the human beings who had come out on it seemed slightly less disturbing, and Dismas began to think. He considered first the many human beings who had not left their rooms at all, those who were waiting for another Tone Imp message, and those who were trying to find out more by using their radios or television sets. But no human broadcast was ever again allowed to arrive in any receiver. And those who disbelieved, those as well who were dead. Within the first hour, while Dismas had been making his way to belief and then to the avenue, many human beings had killed themselves and some had killed their families as well, with or without belief that they knew why they had done so. Dismas felt that he had always been together with himself, and he seemed to understand other human beings well enough for that reason to be able to imagine all such events at once while he walked. He felt that his understanding was due to the number and high quality of the trips he had taken, and that it was also due to his constant residence in New York City, where he had been surrounded at all times by many different sorts of people whom he had always tried to understand. Dismas saw that the city and all in it were at last on one great and defining trip, a trip which was both good and bad because it was a part of reality. And he was grateful, knowing not to whom, for his luck in being down and totally in reality from the first second of that trip. Dismas walked for 10 blocks, living through most of another hour because he stopped over and over again to quiet this human being and then that one, to extricate himself from the many strange scenes in which he had become involved until, continuing uptown for no particular reason, he met another traveler. She was called Mary, but no one knew whether or not that was her true name.
"Where are we going?"
she said as she stepped out of a doorway and began to walk at his side. When he turned to look at her, it was as if the two of them had suddenly been enclosed in a small bubble of silence and peace, and that the fighting, crying, screaming, all else outside did not truly exist. It was reality, but it did not exist. Dismas neither understood nor tried to understand how such a thing could be, but lived entirely in his present and lived all of it that he could, glad to have found a bubble of peace with this girl at that time. "We're going uptown."
"That's where they are?"
I don't know."
"They should be uptown. That's where all the power is. The rich places."
"Not the real power."
"Real enough. The broadcasting stations are uptown mostly, for instance. And they started with the broadcasting thing."
She had never known what her true name was. Mary looked very much like Buffy St. Marie and had no desire to look that way. Most of the girls and some of the boys in Armonk, New York, where she had grown, had called her Buffy. So when she was 14, she began to use lipstick and eyeshadow, and she slid on skin tight to each gentle cheek. in place of rouge, a pink-red heart, just 1 3/4 inches from the bottom to the apex of each double grand curve. At that time, she had had parents, but soon she left Armonk, and she took to calling herself Wanda June, from a feeling of inadequacy, though always wishing to know her true name. Perhaps, she sometimes thought, perhaps it was truly Mary after all. But she could not be sure. She allowed herself only tea because she felt that her true name would be obscured entirely by anything stronger. Since she walked a great deal while thinking and did not eat much, she had become very thin. She was wearing a high school blue mini dress and cut-out sneakers so that, considering her lipstick and eyeshadow and the two pink-red hearts, she looked much more like a groupie than she thought she was. She listened only to the heaviest of new music and to Dylan and to the Mothers of Invention. In her mind now, music rose, blown in the wind, which she had known almost as a lullaby since she had been young. Dismas sat against her music. They could be anywhere. They could be all over.
Then why uptown?
There is no why. We do because we are doing. She asked after his name, and he told it to her. Perhaps, she thought, perhaps I am a part of this, the other part of Dismas, and, she thought, Dismas and Mary. She walked near him through the fear and bravery and insanity of human beings in the bubble of peace. After they had walked for many blocks, she thought that they had a destination, and she thought that she knew what it was.
Rockefeller Center. That's where they all have to be.
They might be anywhere. They might have made another broadcast.
We're going to Rockefeller Center.
We are not going. We are being now.
But we're heading uptown, and in Rockefeller Center, where NBC is, and RCA and all of that, we can find them.
There is not anything but now.
Let me lead you.
Any now had as much right to exist as any other now, and Dismas was unused to such urgency. He felt neither regret nor any other emotion when the girl stepped ahead of him by 2 paces and turned down a street, and then after walking some few blocks, turned again onto another avenue. He followed her because he walked with her in every now he could consider, and that was all. Perhaps the girl thought of Dismas and future. In Dismas, each present inside the bubble filled his mind. When they reached Rockefeller Plaza, the bubble disappeared, and Dismas began to live in the new present as it came to him. The girl had been right. The people from the Crab Nebula, 5 of them, were standing in Rockefeller Plaza over the head of Prometheus. Each of the Toenemph was 8 feet tall. They were chitinous and highly selective carnivores. In color, the brightest green of your mind, or the girl's mind, outlined in the usual feelers and claws of chitinous people. But Dismas, who had no future and needed no plan, had also no past, and so needed no memory. They looked as much like lobsters as Toenemph sounds like the real name of their race. The only human being in the plaza, or visible in Rockefeller Center at all, was a small man in a large uptown suit who carried a microphone, power pack, and much other equipment on his back, in his hands and under his arms, and who crouched with his back to Dismas and to the girl, talking in a whisper to the microphone. There were distant screams. Perhaps St. Patrick's Cathedral was ringing its bells. The Toenemph were not making any perceptible sounds at all. For a second, the girl had stopped, and so Dismas stopped 2 paces behind her.
None of them are looking our way.
Dismas found her whisper surprisingly pleasant, and she began slowly to move forward again. When she came abreast of the crouching man, she stopped. She crouched as the man was doing, and Dismas walked up to both human beings and crouched between the man with the microphone and the girl whom he had met. The Toenemph had so arranged their universe that it included the English language, as other Toenemphs scattered over our planet had made arrangements to include one or more of a wide variety of other languages. The Toenemph, unlike some races, owned the concept of language so that they could adjust themselves and their surroundings in that manner. But they did not need to face an object in order to see it, or even turn their eye stalks in the direction of the object. They saw, all of them, what they wished to see, or what seemed important for them to see. The Toenemph, like most races, being their own judges of importance. An attribute sometimes attained by human beings through the use of yogic disciplines and sometimes in drug-like manner. Their own language was retained for them, and it was a silent language, which consisted for the most part of gestures, bodily attitudes, and the degree to which the upper claws were open. None of the Tonemp owned private names, but they did not mind being numbered, as in this instance from 1 to 5. It's an aid in identification for those to whom names have become important. One said,
I wonder if they plan to attack us. It would be a most foolish move.
2 expressed his doubt. All of the Tonemp were male. They knew of femaleness only through their experience with other races. They reproduced themselves in the same way in which a highly developed computer reproduces itself, by specific construction and the use of much complex machinery. They were a highly industrialized civilization.
We are their superiors. Surely they must know that. To be intelligent is not always to be intelligible. Indeed, a wholly intelligible intelligence is a virtual contradiction in terms which... Wait. Motion has resumed.
The 5 Tonemp, without themselves moving, concentrated their attention on the human beings who were taking the 3 abreast position behind them.
I believe that they will attack.
2 discussions began, one on the matter of possible attack, and the other on the distinction between the intelligent and the intelligible. The Tonemp found both equally interesting. None of the human beings heard or experienced their discussions. Perhaps Dismas would have found one or both interesting, and perhaps if he had owned neither a past nor a future, the girl and the man with a microphone would have been interested too. The man with a microphone had never stopped his whispering. As Dismas and the girl came near to him, they were able to hear most of what he was saying. He was talking about the Tonemp, although he did not know the name of their race and called them simply aliens, and inventing theories regarding other members of the race and what had happened and what was likely to happen. He began to describe the Tonemp physically, speaking very softly.
No broadcasts are getting out. I've tried every station.
Oh, I know that. I have a job to do. What happens after my words leave me is no concern of mine.
But that doesn't make sense.
I have a job to do.
Only what happens now.
What?
It's only what happens now that matters.
You're nuts.
Dismas nodded as the man turned away again and whispered into his microphone. He had begun to describe Dismas and the girl, calling them a brave outpost of humanity.
We've got to do something.
We will.
But what?
Whatever we do, I don't know yet. The weather was exceptionally pleasant for New York as sunset began. A cool wind came from the west, scattering paper and leaves. The air was clearer than usual. The harsh smells of the pavement and the street were made more gentle by the smells of the nearby flowers and grasses of Rockefeller Center. The Tonemp continued their discussion while one became linked with several others in Washington who were talking to the President of the United States. Matters were more clear than they had been in Washington and elsewhere throughout the world.
It is obvious from the appearance of these 2 representatives of common humanity that the human race is not going to knuckle under to these strange and alien beings. No, we were born free and we will die free if need be. The determination on the faces of my companions is strong and sure. Perhaps we will succeed, perhaps fail. But one thing is sure. Human beings are not going to surrender weakly even to such terrors as these alien horrors represent. We will remain human, fighting, hoping, free to the end. And if we have even half a chance, we will show these monsters what it means to be human. We will drive them back to the weird nest from which they have sprung, drive them off the earth with all our might and all our will. Looking at my companions, sure of their thoughts, as I am of my own, I am proud to be a human being. Proud that I am no eldritch horror like these crab-like or lobster-like aliens, but a free and mighty. mighty human being, poised at the beginning of the greatest fight in human history.
The whispering of the announcer disturbed one, who was attempting to retain his link with fellows in Washington as well as the two discussions in Rockefeller Plaza. Casually, he turned and directed at the announcer a weapon which he took from a pouch slung about his upper left pod or shoulder. A beam of light, barely visible and entirely silent, made nearly a straight line between the weapon and the right side of the announcer's body, beside near Dismas. The announcer screamed and fell backward, his clothing charred as well as the skin beneath it. He was no longer conscious, no longer whispering. The girl screamed and stopped as the weapon moved toward her. And Dismas said very quietly, "That's wrong." He stood up and walked toward one.
"Perhaps he means to parley. I wish that he did,"
one said without explaining, and then damaged Dismas with his weapon. Dismas staggered and nearly fell, badly burned along his left arm. He opened his eyes more widely, feeling all of the sensation of pain, and as briefly a past developed for him in the moment of his decision, since no decision exists in this world without a past to give birth to it. Pitying the unconscious announcer who had certainly felt the same burning and the same sickness, he said again, "Wrong," and continued forward. He was very close to one when the girl screamed again and got up to rush toward him.
"There is no help for it."
The weapon appeared to Dismas to change. He saw through a new and private mist the shifting shape of it, and he saw the new color of the light that came from it before he was killed by the light. His death, like all death, was attended by pain, and he felt all of it that he could feel for every separate second in which such feeling remained to him. Behind him, as he fell, the girl reached out a hand and touched him, and in that touch, died instantly within their regrown bubble of two and silence. The presidential broadcast took place that night during what was called prime time. It was several weeks before the announcer, who had been injured in Rockefeller Plaza, was sufficiently recovered to analyze the speech and its effects for the much reduced population of the United States, which was, of course, again listening to its radios and its television sets. The tone amp had cut hair dryers out of their broadcast system, which bothered few people.
The population reduction is, of course, vitally important. But we must remember that we are now rid of our large prison population, of the inmates of our mental hospitals, of many malcontents who would not, who could not, represent our nation, or our planet in such an exalted arena as the Federation of Planets and Systems. The process is perhaps cruel, although the tone amp assures us that each reduction is quite painless. But who shall say that survival of the most fit, the basic law of nature, is not enhanced? In this newest of worlds, engaged as we are in political and perhaps even social contact with planets and systems beyond our imagination, each of us has his or her job to do. The president has called upon us to recognize that fact and to do our jobs, to be creditable and admirable examples of the human race. I'm sure that none of us will fail to meet this challenge.
And one said,
"It is always the most nearly intelligible who are useful to us, those of true intelligence."
The others, recognizing that he was thinking again of the two human growths he had eliminated just as agreement was being reached, attempted some slight comfort.
"True intelligence is not useful in any race but in the tone amp. True intelligence is not practical."
"No, it is not. That is why it is not intelligible. It tends towards goals or structures which do not change with circumstance, as the human being who called wrong, and the other who felt the need to touch that one, disregarding danger."
"Such judgments, such needs, are not intelligible,"
said another, perhaps three or five. The bells of St. Patrick's Cathedral were silent. The tone amp stood in the great flowered gallery of Rockefeller Center, returned there to begin reconstruction of all the details of the communications and symbol structure.
No, they are not. They are not intelligible even to those who have agreed with us upon this planet or upon any other. They are not intelligible to those who might charitably be called intelligent.
The survivors.
And Dismas said nothing at all, but was addressed, having neither past nor present, nor having any more the limitation of space, and being therefore entirely within now, within here, entirely intelligible. Dismas was addressed by his true name, and was made welcome, and the girl was addressed by her true name equally, and so discovered it at last, and was welcomed. For her true name was Mary, as it had always been, as always it would be. For she was named before Dismas, and she had always wanted to help. The story you've heard this time is titled The Bible After Apocalypse. It's written by Lawrence Jennifer, and it appears in a collection edited by Robert Silverberg called New Dimensions 4. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Reading with me was Mary Armantrout. Technical production for MindWebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff.